Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about the larger the city you live in, the more magnetic particles enter your brain, and how breast cancer cover-up continues by Sidney Ross Singer from GreenMed Info. There is a landmark study that shows half of cancer patients are killed by chemotherapy, not cancer, from Claire Burnish from Free Thought Project. Mushrooms, M. mycelium, help the microbiomes in your gut, meaning good bacteria from eating those mushrooms, and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to look at some audio clips, including, it was about 3 weeks ago that I suggested, based upon my observations only, which are subjective, that I believe that Hillary Clinton is suffering from Parkinson's. Now, it could be multiple sclerosis, but I feel it's more Parkinson's because I've counseled a lot of people who have Parkinson's. I did a Parkinson's health support group. And virtually all the things that she's manifesting, including pneumonia, are very common. In fact, it's one of the most common reasons people with Parkinson's die. So let's just say that I'm wrong, that it's everything they said. It's just that she got too much sun, was too hot. Well, it was only 74 degrees. Why is it that 500,000 other people didn't get too much sun, didn't faint? Now, if she did have pneumonia, as we were told, why would she go out on the street immediately and hug a little girl? That's a stupid thing to do if you're diagnosed with pneumonia. If you had pneumonia, you're put in a hospital, you're put on in intensive care, you're given intravenous drugs and also given fluids. So I believe, that is my belief, that we are watching a massive health crisis cover-up. But knowing how well the Clinton machine works, how much control it has over the media, it is not surprising that no one has asked in the mainstream media, will you show us all of your medical records and allow us to have an independent group of physicians examine those records? And I think when you're going from the most powerful position in the world, that's the least you could do. But instead, I believe that they will deny it because that's what they do. Remember, it's not just Hillary and Bill Clinton. You're dealing with a virtual brigade of handlers, people who are locked into their system. These are the technocrats. These are the corporate entities. And they all have something at risk if she doesn't become president, or if her health crisis, or something that is leaked in the next week by Julian Assange should get her out of the race. Because then, based upon the rules, the second largest getter of delegates would be Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders would be right back in there. And Bernie Sanders would easily defeat Donald Trump. So this is going to be interesting. So today, you're going to hear from a medical doctor, a person with 37 years experience in medicine, who will give you his input. And again, we must state for fairness that no one has had a chance outside of her medical team to evaluate her. But clearly, they're hiding something. And if you know anything about the Clintons from their early days, which I do, you know that they're pathological liars. So I trust nothing that they or anyone around them says. You'll hear from a doctor. Also today, when I heard Hillary Clinton and others, including Barack Obama, and virtually everyone on the right, say that, you know, Edward Snowden was a traitor, some went as far as to suggest he should be assassinated. I think they're all wrong, but I'm not going to tell you what's wrong. Today, Edward Snowden, in his own words, will tell you who really rules the United States. I think you'll find it informative. Also today, we will have a short clip, very short clip, about a group of blacks who believe that Hillary Clinton does not serve their interest, and they believe that she has a history of killing people of color. Now, you haven't seen this in the media, and I'm going to give you my take on this, and then also we'll do a reality check on the Dakota protesters' attack with pepper spray and attack dogs while defending ancient burial sites. And the energy company bulldozes burial sites before a judge can intervene. We always like to keep you up to date on everything that's essential. Let's begin. When you walk down the streets of Manhattan, depending upon the day, you can find that the skies are fairly clear. And especially in the autumn, there's just a wonderful feeling. I love walking around the city. In fact, I frequently walk from where I live on the Upper West Side down to the West Village, down to Soho, just enjoying the sights, the smells, the sounds of the city. What we don't see, but is not good for us, are those little particulate matters. This is the latest study on this, and this is from PreventDisease.com. Quote, can traffic fumes go to your head? Ultra-fine particles of metal in exhaust gases fly up your nose and travel into your brains, where they contribute to diseases associated with the central nervous system. And the more congested the city, the bigger the problem. Iron nanoparticles were already known to be present in the brain, but they were thought to come from the iron naturally found in our bodies derived from food. Now a closer look at their structure suggests the particles mostly come from air pollution sources like traffic fumes and coal burning. And the findings are smoking guns, says Professor Barbara Mayer of Lancaster University in the United Kingdom. Why? Why should you be concerned? Because think of it for a moment. Let's just say you live on the Upper East Side or a nice area of Brooklyn or Queens where your street has trees, homes, everything seems to be working fine. If you live on the Upper East Side, you're living in an apartment, you have views of the city more often than not, and your inside of your apartment looks fine. You don't see what's almost invisible because it's so small. If you were to be able to put on a pair of glasses, for example, and I recently did this when teaching some people about animal food safety, I said, does this counter look clean? Yeah, it's clean. How do you know it's clean? Well, I cleaned it. And you cleaned it with what? A sponge. Do you know a sponge is the dirtiest thing in your house? No. Yeah, because everything is dirty, everything is grimy, all the oils that it picks up, it then creates a bacteria. It's like wiping a petri dish that's overgrowing. So you take a simple blue light, and when you shine the blue light, gee whiz, you start to see all the things you didn't know were there. And I said, the only way to properly clean a surface is you put either hydrogen peroxide or rubbing alcohol and you scrub it. And it's the scrubbing that breaks the outer envelope if it's a virus or wipes up the bacteria. Now, it may look the same, but one is disinfected, the other is not. The same would be true if you woke up in the morning, put glasses on when you walked outside and you suddenly saw all the pollution. When you're going onto a bus, and every time someone coughs, you'll see bacteria and viruses in their mouth going from one end of the bus to the other. How do we know? Simple. There was a study. Study done in Parliament. When a lot of people began to get sick, they wanted to know what was causing this. So when Parliament was empty, they put a petri dish. That's a medium, usually with an agar base, where you grow out bacteria or viruses. And you put it on every single dish. A seat, then you had an orator come in and talking as a person in Parliament would normally talk, they sprayed a non-lethal bacterium into the man's throat. The next morning, just after standing in one place at one end of the Parliament, every single seat was contaminated. The petri dishes were all growing out what was in his mouth. That means that if you're within 25 to 30 feet of someone, whatever's in there coming out of their body is going to be impacting you. Now, that does not mean that that's how we all get sick. Yes, there was a time when we didn't know about bacteria and viruses. For example, in 1340, the plague in England there was about 200,000 people living in London at the time. It killed 100,000, half the people. 50% of the people died. And what they didn't know was that you can't be around anyone who's got the plague. Where'd the plague come from? Came from rats and fleas that would be infected from the rats and then go into someone's home. And then they would bite the people, flea bites, because there was no hygiene. By the way, just give me an idea. Because when we look back, maybe at a Jane Austen film, where it's always bucolic and beautiful, and the language was so perfect, the vernacular was so much deeper than ours today, and there was a sense of genteel sarcasm about everything. They were polite in how they said it, but like Oscar Wilde, you know, their tongue was as sharp as a razor. But then look at the reality. The reality is that in the 14th century, in the growing metropolitan area of London, where the ships are coming in on the river, you had people living, lots of people. And 200,000 people in a small area is constantly congested. Now, mind you, they were taking advantage of bringing in wines from Italy and silks from other countries and pottery, masonry. They were there to supply, the mercantile class was there to supply people with what they could afford to buy. But here's what you didn't have. You didn't have any hygiene at all. Now, what I mean by at all, I don't care if you're rich, middle class, poor, or the king, you were still susceptible. Why? Because there were no paved roads. Now, yes, there were some paved roads in the Roman times, but we're talking about in London where there were, you didn't find that. Instead, you had mud paths. The trouble is, if you're ever in England very long, you know how beautiful the countryside is. One of the reasons it's beautiful is because of the temperature and that rain all the time. Well, that's fine if you're out in the country looking at a field. It's not fine if you're 200,000 people walking up and down roads. It's just going to be nothing but mud. But then it's not just the mud. It's the fact that all the livestock were there. They didn't have separate areas of the city. They did have a couple areas set aside for butchering. And then you had what were called master butchers, the people who knew how to butcher an animal. But the animals frequently, especially pigs, they lived right there. They were loose, they were defecating nonstop. But so were cows and horses and chickens. And then you had the fishmongers. And the fish would come in the boats, and they would buy them in these burlap bags, and they would dump them on tables. There was no ice. And the fish would stay there until they were too rank, or you started seeing little worms, maggots coming out of them, and then you would throw them away. Where'd they throw them? Right in the street. So there was no hygiene whatsoever. They did hire some people, and one of these guys was famous because he could move 7 tons, that's 14,000 pounds of feces per night, off just one area of a road. And he was paid, I think it was 18 shillings, versus the average worker would be paid 6 shillings. Now, where did they put it? Where they were supposed to take it outside the city, they didn't. They'd dump it in the river. Everything got dumped in the river, or a lot. But people would, everyone has to defecate and urinate. They would go into a simple wooden bucket, and they simply open the door and throw it out. Now, it got really bad, because imagine in the summertime. Imagine when there is such humidity and you have 200,000 people all throwing their defecation into narrow streets, and then you got the animals on top of that. Then after they slaughtered the animals, they would throw the remains of, well, the wealthier classes would get the so-called better cuts of meat. They were still contaminated, by the way. There was no hygiene whatsoever. And the poor people would get the entrails. And one of those was pig's gut. Now, in the South, I come from the South. My family's from North Carolina and Kentucky and Virginia. That's where both my mom and dad's family grew up. And so there's some common habits down there that historically were really stupid. One of them was chitlins, and the other was, and what you do, you take the inside of a pig's intestine, which is filled with what? It's filled with feces. That's all it is, feces. And there might be 10, 15 pounds, 20 pounds, 30 pounds, and you tie off the ends, you boil it, and you eat it. Or if you're a more civilized society, like Italy or France or England, you squish out, just imagine holding up this giant intestine, and you hold one in, and then you just kind of press your finger and thumb down, and you take the whole thing out. So all that feces goes out. Ah, now you got a clean intestine. No, it's not clean. It's filthy. And then you stuff putrid meats and lots of salt up inside of it, and then you make it into tags and you boil it. And that's what people eat. That's your sausage. That's the casing of the sausage pigs got. Anyhow, the poor got that. The wealthy got the better cuts. But they ate a lot of brain. They ate a lot of kidney. And they had a kidney pie, which is still common over there. In any case, everything was thrown into the streets. And so it stunk so bad that even the King of England complained about how smelly everything was. But that's just the environment. Your shoes would be constantly impacted, and because it was so slushy and sloppy, they'd go clear up your pants, your dress, everything would be just covered in feces. But then you go into your home, you're not going to have any water. Water all came from outside, and most of that water came from the Thames River, and that would have been polluted, dead bodies in there, all this debris in there. You never bathed. The only time you ever bathed, you might bathe your face, maybe your hands, depending upon where you work. But people just didn't get naked and get into a bathtub because, first of all, that would have taken up a lot of space. You had no place to drain the water, and you'd have to fill up the water with, you know, by boiling it first. And that's where families would then take a bath based upon the priority of the person in the family. The oldest male, then the next oldest, et cetera, then the oldest female. And then finally, and that's where the term don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And then you ate whatever was in a pot, and the pot was on the hearth, and the hearth could be there for weeks, months, or years and never be cleaned. So just imagine every day you start off with some brown rice on Monday, but now it's Tuesday, you throw some peas in there. And on Wednesday, you throw some corn in there. And you just keep stirring and heating and eating. And hence the term peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold, peas porridge in the pot, 9 days old. Try 90 days. And so people never brushed their teeth. They never flossed. They had no toilet paper. They didn't wipe. Now, that's gross, but it's not gross if you're used to everyone else's smell. So your breath smelled. Your body was terribly smelly. Your hair would be filled with lice. And frequently people wore wigs because they had to cut off their hair because of the head lice. Your gums would be constantly bacterial filled. So if you kiss someone, you're going to get all their pus going right into your mouth. And just imagine someone popping a pimple in your mouth. That's what it would have been like kissing someone in the 14th century. That's gross, isn't it? Oh, God. And you're having your mushroom soup right now. So anyhow, but just imagine having sex with people. Oh, God, man. I'm sure they must have had some celibate movement even back then, because the smell would have been just outrageous. And the infections, the uterine infections, the vaginal infections, all the urethra infections, because bacteria and virus have been everywhere. And to think there was a time in Roman history where people who were wealthy enough had their own indoor mineral baths and different heated baths indoor. So they might bathe 2-3 times a day in clean water that was constantly running. By the way, that's not for all Romans. The average Roman would go to a public toilet, which was frequently very dangerous because the methane was in there. And they had, get this, the average Roman didn't have toilet paper, but in every one of the public toilets, there would be a brush. It would be a wooden brush. At the end would be like something like a sponge. And that's what you would wipe yourself with. But they didn't ever clean it. So you'd be wiping yourself with the same thing that 10,000 other people would wipe themselves with. So there were some good things about the Roman Empire and some that were not so good. In fact, they were so gross that they would even bring in special combs to comb their hair, so to help get some of the massive debris of all this feces out of it. Anyhow, they would frequently find explosions, and since no one ever cleaned the public cisterns, and there'd be all kinds of little creatures, rats and spiders, even snakes that come up and bite you. So a lot of people didn't like that. Anyhow, there was no good hygiene in England at all in the cities. People died. The average lifetime was 35, and there was no hygiene whatsoever. So now compare then to now, and we still don't get it right. You eat meat, you go into a restaurant, they just cut the chicken, they just cut the fish, they just cut the beef, they just cut the pork, they just cut the lamb or veal on a table, and now they're cutting your salad or your bread. And we wonder why we have over 200 million cases of food poisoning in the United States each year. Anyhow, so could you imagine if you had a pair of glasses that let you see all the really serious pathogenic bacteria and viruses that are in our environment? Would we do anything differently? I believe we would. But we don't, so we don't see what's right in front of us. So I'm merely suggesting that the more congested the city you live in, the more car exhaust there is, then you're going to be inhaling dust from various origins, and these can cause chronic inflammation of your lungs. They can cause rheumatoid arthritis. They can cause the nanoparticles to impact asthma, bronchitis, emphysema, lung cancer, and neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So this is why you have to be very conscious of keeping the air where you live clean, because the air you live in is not. And also, this is the latest from GreenMedInfo, Sydney Ross Singer, quote, "Breast cancer is one of the major killers of women in the United States. It is also one of the most overdiagnosed and overtreated conditions. Sadly, most women have no idea that simply not wearing a bra can have a major impact on the likelihood of developing breast cancer." You probably didn't hear about a recent study from Brazil. It was just published a couple months ago in the Journal of Advances in Oncology Research and Treatments. It was entitled "Wearing a Tight Bra for Many Hours a Day is Associated with Increased Risk of Breast Cancer." And there, that, by the way, there was a second study the year before also confirming a bra cancer link. I reported on this first over 35 years ago. There's another study in Venezuela and another study in Scotland, another study out of China. So it's not new. Lots of studies from around the world. But you have to compare that to the hundreds, billions of dollar a year cancer industry, and especially Think Pink October, where everybody tries to get you to think pink and donate to a charity, and you do, and ask yourself, well, what are they doing with all that money? Well, how about helping themselves? Here's what you should know. Why are you wearing a bra? You don't need a bra. And bras can lead to discomfort and disease, headaches, backaches, nerve damage to the hands, deep shoulder grooves, droopy breasts, breast pain, cysts and lumps, and breast cancer are all some of the problems that bras cause. And like the corset, bras are harmful garments that constrict and shape the body through pressure, which impairs circulation, and especially the circulation of the immune system's lymphatic pathways. And this results in fluid accumulation in the breast, and that can cause cysts and pain and tissue toxification. So you want to have your breasts being able to be healthy and have lymphatic massage under your armpits, across underneath your breast, and that allows all of that trapped tissue, lymphatic tissue, to drain, and that's what you want. So study after study shows that wearing bras are dangerous. You don't need them. And think twice before you give again to the Susan G. Komen Foundation or the American Cancer Society. I invite them both on this program, respectfully, to show me where they have spent all their money in all these decades, and what do we have to show for it. I'm Gary Null. Now we're going to go over, and I want you to hear just about a minute of this very short, because it's all repetitive. They keep saying the same thing over and over, but they make their point. This is a group of black individuals, a large group, protesting, saying that Hillary Clinton kills black people. Please listen.
So that myth, that whole myth that black people are going to support her, it's going to be exposed. It's going to be over with. So she won't win if it comes to black votes. Because these people are going to march across the country, and they're going to keep educating and keep educating and keep educating. That won't happen. That's the real deal. She's killing black people. Don't vote for Hillary. She's killing black people. Don't vote for Hillary. She's killing black people. Don't vote for Hillary. She's killing black people.
Okay, now they go on for about a minute saying that. Now, you could agree or disagree. Let me add something into this to possibly reshape the understanding to a larger issue. When you deal with Bill Clinton, you're dealing with Hillary, as now has been confirmed by insiders, Secret Service agents, and others who've worked with them in the White House, the Clinton White House, for 8 years. She was the one who really called the shots. He is the charismatic person that no matter how salacious his actions are, he's always forgiven. That's what happens when you're a Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan, where people simply like you because you're charming. The same will be true with Barack Obama. I project now that Barack Obama will be the first billionaire ex-president in American history because of all the deals he's done against the people, but he did it for corporate America, and there's going to be a big payback. But people forgive him because they like him. But now we go back to the Samoa Civil War of 1990. And through 1992-93, 1 million deaths, including 350,000 by starvation. And then the Samoa Massacre occurred in 1993, all under Bill Clinton's watch. Could have stopped it, chose not to. Then you have Clinton's first term, the Iraqi sanctions, 567,000 children, conservatively. I've seen figures high as almost 700,000 dead. Let me put that in perspective. 4,000 kids under 5 years of age were dying each month. And that was considered by the Clintons, including Hillary, to be acceptable. Those are people of color, by the way. And before Bill Clinton's first effort, the literacy rate in Iraq was 93 to 95%, one of the most educated countries in the world. After his sanctions, 20%. Then look at the Bosnian War. That was Bill Clinton's war in 1992 to 95. You relied about everything in that, 100,000 dead. Then you had Rwanda in 1994. 890,000 Tutsis were slaughtered. Some say it was actually closer to 2 million in a more recent historical analysis, scholarly analysis. Repeatedly, history shows that the Clintons were informed, they were aware it was genocide, they chose not to engage. Then you have Honduras in 2009. Now, the most recent figures we have is that thousands were killed after Hillary Clinton backed the coup that overthrew a democratically elected population, again, people of color, in Honduras. And now Honduras is considered the most dangerous place for population to deaths per year on the planet. So we can thank Hillary for that. Libya, that's strictly Hillary Clinton's death count. How many dead? Minimum of 30 to 50,000, plus over 100,000 wounded. And yet before it was the most advanced, longest lived, wealthiest people in all of Africa. That's Hillary's. Then in Syria, because we now have absolute irrefutable proof that her State Department worked with terrorist groups to undermine the Assad regime, and they were putting their people in there in those student demonstrations to make it look like it was all one-sided. It wasn't. How many dead? Upwards of 470,000. Ukraine, mostly in Donbass region, 8,000 dead. That's a very conservative figure, and that's from the Ukrainian fascist government. And then you have the Yemen war. Remember, she's been meeting as Secretary of State all along with Saudi Arabia. The minimum you have is 27,000 casualties in Yemen. And I'm doing a full 1 hour tomorrow evening in the Progressive Commentary on Yemen. Plus, you have all the people who ended up dying because the war on drugs and because of the mass incarceration, and then the violence of supporting the Colombian government and then supporting the Mexican government, over 100,000 killed in the war on drugs, instead of ending the war on drugs. And isn't it a little ironic that Barack Obama, George Bush, and Bill Clinton all used drugs, hard drugs, that if they were not to be the future presidents, if they were to be rounded up in any drug raid, they would have been ex-cons. And yet they all pushed for harder sentences, longer sentences. But it was Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton that talked about the predatory blacks, the inner city blacks, you know, that they were not human. They had to be brought to heel like they're on a leash. So when someone says that Hillary Clinton has one set of values for one group of people and a different set for another, remember, outside of election time, outside when a politician will say anything, get elected, what have they actually done? Look at their deeds, look at their actions, and then ask, who does she speak for? It's assumed that all blacks are going to vote for because, well, he was the first black president, wasn't he? The cool guy with the, you know, the sunglasses playing the sax. And he kept going off to Baptist churches every time he got caught in an affair. And by the way, his original lover, the one who was his girlfriend and from the age of 13 on, they had a 30-year relationship, told me, and she's the highest-ranked, I don't know how to put this, she's a lawyer in Texas, and he bragged about having 2,000 conquests before he even became governor. And Hillary was aware of this. She was only angry when he got caught. So what kind of people are we voting for? What does this say to the world? When was the last time we voted for someone who had the character and morals and ethics and the worldview and an idea of peace like a Mahatma Gandhi or a Malcolm X or Martin Luther King? Why don't we ever support people who have high spiritual awareness and seek peace with peace? So something to consider. And where was Hillary Clinton when it came to Indian rights? And where was Hillary Clinton when it came to putting the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its taking away all rights of all Americans ahead of your sovereignty? And where was she on the Keystone Pipeline, letting a pipeline go through Native American territory? Just a question. I want you to hear from Edward Snowden in his own words, because all you've heard on the media, in most media, is how he's this terrible traitor, deserves to be in prison or killed, and no one is focusing upon what he actually uncovered, the systemic corruption within our government. Why aren't they focusing upon that? Here's Edward Snowden.
Family. You know, my grandfather was in the military. My father was in the military. My mother still works for the government. My sister works for the government. And I worked for the government. I was a staff officer for the Central Intelligence Agency. I had signed up to join the U.S. military in the wake of the September 11th attacks. I actually signed up for the invasion of Iraq because I believe that fundamentally our government had noble intents, and it did good things, and it did them for the right reasons. What I was not aware of, and I've grown to become a little more sophisticated in this, is that while the people in government largely are exactly that, they're good people trying to do good things for the right reasons, there is a culture that sort of pervades the upper levels of government, the senior officials, political appointees, that have basically become less accountable to the public that they serve. And because of that, we see that politics and policies irrevocably, sort of irresistibly, they gravitate towards the prerogatives of individuals, of these officials, of an elected and unelected class of bureaucrats that can sort of degrade the quality of government that we as individuals enjoy. So as I went through my time in the classified world, the intelligence community, as we call it, and I moved from the Central Intelligence Agency to the National Security Agency, I worked on both the public sides and the private sides as a contractor working for private companies, but at a government desk in government facilities using government equipment and working on government programs and taking tasking from government employees. I gained an increasingly concerning understanding of what happens on the broad scale, what the results of all these individual decisions are. And that's generally that when decisions are made in the dark, the quality of those decisions is reduced. Now, that's not to say that we need to know every decision that the government makes, you know, who's under investigation, what this particular program does, but we do have to have a general understanding of the policies and the powers broadly that a government claims if it's going to be using them in our name, as well as being using them against us. And ultimately, toward the end of my tenure at the NSA, I discovered that there were programs of mass surveillance that were happening beyond any possible statutory authority because these things were constitutionally prohibited. And I saw that these were things that never should have happened. They were initially authorized in the Bush administration, and that administration actually was fully aware in their own classified opinions in the Inspector General's report that those programs had no statutory basis. And so we saw developments where they were trying to authorize these under the president's powers, you know, they're using Article 2 powers, where basically the president says, we're at war, I can do basically whatever I want. Now, that may sound like a great idea and be an important power in times of total war, in times of existential threat, but we don't have U-boats in the harbor. We don't have, you know, foreign armies marching on American soil. We haven't seen total war policies in the United States since World War II. And so we have to ask, why were these decisions being made? Why was the public not allowed to participate in the debate? And why is it that even within the separate branches of government, officials were not aware of this? Within the executive branch, you know, in the intelligence community, many of my coworkers, who also had top secret clearances, high level accesses, were unaware that these things were going on. The vast majority of Congress had no idea that these programs had been instituted or were being maintained. Even those on the intelligence intelligence committees, in both the Senate and the House, were not fully briefed. Only the gang of eight, that'd be the chairs, the ranking members, and then the majority and minority leaders for both houses, are briefed on so-called covert action programs and things like that, exceptionally compartmented programs. And the courts have increasingly, in the wake of the post 9/11 period, become reluctant to scrutinize any decisions or programs that were constitutionally questionable, saying that they lacked the expertise or the positioning or what it ultimately boiled down to was the political willingness to confront difficult questions to which there may or may not be right answers once they're right and wrong. So this led me to stand up and say something about it. And I worked with American journalists and American news outlets to make sure that the public had an ability to make decisions about where the lines in this program should be drawn. Many people are familiar with the story since then. It's still ongoing, the reporting continues. But the ultimate basis are that many people consider the last year's surveillance of unconstitutional activity at the NSA and so on and so forth to be ultimately about surveillance and mass surveillance. And that is a critical issue, and it's the one with which I'm most familiar, and I saw the greatest wrongdoing. However, it's important to be aware that the reality that mass surveillance illustrates is that we have agencies that are working on their own authorities, they're working on their own sort of institutional momentum to implement programs without oversight, creating these things behind closed doors without the awareness of the public, that are actually changing the boundaries of the rights that we enjoy as free people in a free society. We have lost, in many ways, the freedom to associate without judgment in the United States because of the metadata program, that's really an associational tracking program. When we have everyone's call records, we know who everyone's friends are. We know who they contact. We know what they do. We know when they travel. We know where they go. We know how long they're there. There are speech implications to this. There are obviously privacy implications to this. And there is a very strong argument to be made that even if we as a society believe that these powers and authorities would be valuable, that we could not institute them through statute regardless, that they simply would be unconstitutional in any form, absent an amendment. And we see this happening and being upheld even through international laws decisions very recently. 2 or 3 days ago, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Countering Terrorism and Protecting Human Rights delivered a report that had been in the works for, I believe, several years that found that mass surveillance programs violate the obligations of states that the United States and the United Kingdom and other many of our other allies have agreed to under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. As well as, and this wasn't mentioned specifically, but the very same right that he was highlighting in this report was an obligation we had agreed to under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, some 50-odd years back. And that's Article 12, and that's that we all have a right to privacy, to be free from unjustified, unreasonable intrusions into our lives. And we have this, of course, under our Fourth Amendment. So when it came to my story and how I came forward, it was not that I saw a particular program and I had an axe to grind.
So there you have it. He is seeing a government that is out of control, where each individual branch of government is acting autonomously, breaking the law, violating our constitutional rights, and not being held accountable. So instead of finding out what they're doing illegally, for example, torture is illegal, yet a lot of different agencies of government was aware of it, participated in it, and then helped cover it up. We also found that that listening in on people's cell phones and computers, and taking everything off their internet, and then having it analyzed, normal Americans, is unconstitutional. But there's no consequence. So there's never a consequence to people working in an agency, providing you're doing what you're told to do, even if it's illegal, and even if it represents something as high as a crime against human nature. But if you expose it, if you report on it, if you tell the significance, then you're attacked for the fact that you broke your sacred vow not to tell the truth. Now, he made an interesting point. He said there are principally 8 people who know all the secrets. When was last time any head of the House or Senate intelligence committees came forward and says, I have been made aware that we have been engaging in regime change, which is illegal, goes against all the international laws, and I believe that the American public should know this so they can stop it. Name me the legislator, name me the person in the House or Senate that's told us we've got a problem and you should focus on it, and here's the problem. They won't, because they're honoring an arbitrary law that's meant to protect those people who would otherwise be held accountable for illegal activity. It's absurd. Anyway, I wanted you to hear from him himself in that. So your opportunity to share your points of view. Why is it that as a country, instead of honoring the people, Mr. Karakawa and others, Drake and Snowden, who have told us the truth? They have. Their only crime is that they broke their vow of silence in participating in crimes against the American people. And they should be held as heroes, in my opinion, not vilified for that. 888-874-4888. Now, finally, I want to share a little bit. We don't have a lot of time here, but I'd like for you to hear from Dr. Ted Noel, because this came after what I had told you, what I thought based upon all that she was manifesting. These are all symptoms of Parkinson's. Let's hear what he has to say on this.
Welcome to VidZet.com. My name is Ted Noel. I'm a medical doctor with 36 years of experience, but I am not Hillary Clinton's treating physician. So I can't claim that what I'm about to tell you is a conclusive diagnosis. What I can do is exactly what the CIA does. I look at the public record, and then I put it together to see if there's a single story that explains all of the odd things we see with Hillary and arrive at an answer as to what's going on medically with her. On August 14, Joe Biggs of InfoWars reported that Secret Service agents had approached him with information that Hillary Clinton was suffering from Parkinson's disease. They've had to take steps to accommodate her disease. They also indicated that they have known she's had Parkinson's disease for an extended period. It has become so severe that they are seriously concerned about her ability to perform the duties of president if she is elected. This is a highly unusual circumstance because Secret Service agents are cleared top secret and are prohibited from disclosing this sort of protected information. The only obvious reason for them to speak to a reporter is that they see Hillary Clinton as an imminent threat to national security because of her disease. Days after InfoWars, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks released Hillary Clinton emails where she directs State Department staff to research new drugs to treat Parkinson's disease. Let's connect the dots. On January 31, 2005, Hillary Clinton fainted during a speech. Secret Service agents kept her from injuring herself as she fell. Her public explanation was that she was ill and dehydrated. She left the stage to remove an outer jacket rather than removing it on stage. Oddly, she did not seek medical attention unless she received it off stage before returning. June 18, 2009, Hillary Clinton broke her elbow, quote, on her way to the White House, close quote. Again, we do not have video. But this is also a bit odd since she has had 24/7 Secret Service protection for 24 years. She would have to fall at a distance from them with no warning, or they would have broken her fall as they did in 2005. Early in December 2012, Hillary Clinton fell at home, struck her head, and suffered a concussion. Like the 2005 fall, the public explanation was dehydration and fainting. But again, this is very odd. To strike your head requires a complete loss of protective reflexes. Being wobbly from dehydration won't do this. At this point, let's look at the Secret Service Parkinson's disease story. If Hillary has Parkinson's disease, all three falls make sense. In 2005, she could have felt herself starting to have problems and went off stage to get an apomorphine shot for a quick fix. Unfortunately, it didn't work and she fell. The 2009 fall is stranger, but this is well explained by a Parkinson's freeze event. As one Parkinson's sufferer put it, "One minute I'm upright and sailing along. The next, the asphalt is rushing up at me. The alarms sound, the adrenaline spikes, the needles jump into the red, we're going down. Shields up, shields up." But there are no shields. 180 pounds of vulnerable flesh and bone crashes to the earth. Hillary probably froze and then fell. Either she recovered enough to avoid major injury as she was falling, or she was simply lucky. Then came 2012 and the concussion. This time, the freeze was unlucky. No one was there to catch her fall, and the damage was major. Now, let's be clear here. This is not a firm diagnosis. I am a doctor, but I am not her treating physician. But everything so far fits the theory. Her, quote, medical clearance letter, close quote, is a typical response managed by a politician who lies about everything. She has not released any records, whatever, from the hospitals where she was treated. In other words, Hillary Clinton is asking us to take her word for it. A month after the fall, Hillary's closest aide, Huma Abedin, said in an email that Hillary was often confused. That's not a big surprise because Hillary had a bad concussion and was recovering from a closed head injury. The Fresnel glasses Hillary wore for a while aren't a big deal either, since they were helping with the double vision she had after the concussion. But we should remember that our theory is that the concussion is the result of a bigger neurological problem, not the cause of a continuing problem. Post-concussion syndromes generally recover. A post-concussion syndrome doesn't explain the other things we see. Early in 2016, Hillary's problems started to be really obvious. Videos of odd physical movements and brain freezes became common. This is consistent with progression of Parkinson's disease into its later and more troublesome stages. The first picture to surface is Hillary being helped up a set of porch steps in February. Once again, If she froze while climbing the steps, the people right next to her could catch her and keep her from injury. Suddenly, we start seeing lots of video evidence. In April, Hillary Clinton spent a large part of an appearance nodding her head. To most people, that was just odd. But if we think about Parkinson's disease, it's obvious. This is a head nodding tremor. She was simply present as discussion went on around her, and the tremor showed up as she was at rest. The same tremor showed up when Bernie Sanders endorsed her for president. One website counted over 400 nods then. Before we go further, it's necessary to fill in some medical background. Parkinson's disease causes tremors at rest. That is, when a hand is simply resting, the tremor can take over, but using the hand in a purposeful act will suppress the tremor. Other things that Parkinson's sufferers often do is to place their hands in unnatural and even painful positions. One very common feature is placing the middle finger above the back of the index finger rather than leaving it in line with the others. On May 2, Hillary Clinton is standing on a stage without a lectern. As she speaks, she uses two techniques to hide tremors in her hands. First, she keeps her hands busy. Second, when she's not using her free hand, she presses it to her chest, thus making any tremor almost invisible. The problem with this strategy is that it's not perfect. In the beginning, Hillary's right hand behaves normally as she waves it around to emphasize her speech. Then she presses it to her chest briefly. Then she gestures again with her right hand. But this time, her Parkinson's disease takes over, and it's likely she isn't even aware of it. Hillary's right hand assumes a frankly painful position, which includes her middle finger above her index finger. Professionals who care for Parkinson's patients recognize this as a common Parkinson's disease hand posture. This is one of the most famous of Hillary's odd events. One of the reporters there, Lisa Lehrer, has written that it was nothing important, but the video tells a different story. Several reporters shouted questions at the same time. Immediately, Hillary's head started to bob in an exaggerated manner, slowed down, and then repeated bobbing. After that, she ad-libbed, "You've got to try the iced chai." Several websites have called this a seizure. It's not. It's another Parkinson's disease problem, but this time it's from the treatment, not the disease. It's an example of Parkinson's disease levodopa-induced dyskinesia, or PD-LID. There's only one basic medicine that's effective in managing Parkinson's disease. Levodopa replaces dopamine the brain loses as cells in the substantia nigra, one of the coordination centers in the brain, die. Levodopa generally works well, but not all of the time. A freeze can happen randomly with a visual stimulus or in a moment of stress. In this case, multiple questions at the same time created stress, and when Hillary froze, PD-LID took over. PD-LID causes odd motions, such as Hillary's exaggerated head movements. It doesn't cause loss of consciousness, so she was able to recover verbally. PD-LID happens to every Parkinson's disease sufferer who has been on levodopa for more than 10 years. It's a side effect of the drug, and there is no effective treatment. This is why Hillary Clinton refuses to do news conferences. The stress of multiple questions at once would likely set off multiple PD-LID and freezing events. She would instantly become unelectable. All of us are familiar with Michael J. Fox. On the left, we see him in Back to the Future. On the right, we see him off his meds, showing the full fury of Parkinson's disease. Notice his eyes. This bug-eyed look is common in Parkinson's disease. At the Democratic National Convention during the balloon drop, we saw an astonishing scene. Hillary saw something directly ahead. A normal startle reaction would lock her in that direction, but that's not what happens. Instead, her head jerks hard left, then up. Her eyes pull right, and her head follows. Then her eyes reverse to the left, and her head follows again. All through this, her mouth is unnaturally wide open, and she has bug eyes. Every element of this is common in Parkinson's disease.
Okay, now there, let us keep in mind that clearly something is happening with Hillary Clinton's health. The corporate media will do all it can to downplay it, make it insignificant, and to cover it up. But knowing the Clintons, they will never come forward because they've doubled down on the lie. For them to now say she has these conditions would mean that she knew it all along, that a lot of people participated, covered it up, and then people would trust her even less. We want a healthy individual, healthy physically, healthy mentally, and there is help a person could get, even holistic health for Parkinson's, but that's not the issue. The issue is that we're not being told the full story. We do not know what the full story is. We have not seen the medical records, nor have we had an independent neurologist do an examination. I believe that's absolutely necessary. Finally, I want to thank 78,359, what a number from last night, listening over the telephone to the 7-hour special I did on 9/11. And the big numbers, that's big, but the big numbers are going to come from the downloads. If you want to hear any part of that 7-hour special, I'll give you our archive number, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. And for those of you living in California listening, I got an email from Roy of Roy of Hollywood, Roy Tuckman, and he listened for the entire program last night and said it was just, you know, devastating. Could he play it out there on his show? And I said, sure. So you'll be able to hear it on his show as well. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.